Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka, welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in the studio today is Dr. Judy Dlamini. She is the founder and executive chairperson of the Imbakani Group and the former chairperson of Aspen Pharmacare Limited. Her previous board engagements have included Anglo-American, Discovery Holdings, a JSE-listed financial services company, where she chaired the Remuneration and Transformation Committees, Woolworths Holdings, and several others. Dr. Dlamini is qualified as a medical doctor from the University of Natal, and she also obtained her doctorate in business leadership from UNISA. She is the recipient of the African Economy Builder Lifetime Achievement Award for 2016 from the African Economy Builder Forum, the Global CEO's 2016 Africa's Most Influential Woman in Business and Government, SADC South Award for the Business and Professional Services Sector at regional and national level, and she also won the Fabulous Woman Award in 2016. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Now, you qualified as a medical doctor way back in 1985 from the University of Natal. Mm-hmm. You practiced as a family practitioner for many years, mm-hmm, before consulting in occupational health for various companies, including Rainbow Chicken, DivPak, a Nampak subsidiary, and the National Ports Operation. After you completed your MBA and majored in corporate finance, you joined HSBC Investment Bank, the Johannesburg division in corporate finance. And when you look at the transition from going through from medicine through to the financial sector, it's quite a serious change in direction. And I say I take my hat off to you, because that must have taken incredible courage, belief in yourself, and belief in your future life's journey. Can you please share with us a few of your inner thoughts on this particular period in your life?
It was scary. It was very scary because I had always wanted to be a doctor, a medical doctor, from the age of 4. That's all I wanted to be. And when I lost the passion, and it's a combination of things as to why I lost the passion. Obviously, you never know, but I just assumed that because I was affected by crime, I was robbed at gunpoint outside my practice. It changed the whole perspective, and I felt unsafe. And so, amongst other things, that's one of the things that made me lose my passion. I sold my practice. I had a bakery business next to my practice. I sold that. We sold the house. We moved out of the township. We're still in Durban then, and we moved to town. And I opened a practice in town, which was very different. It felt like, I just felt a part of losing the passion was that I just drove home and thought, if I didn't come to work, I wouldn't be missed. When I was in the township, it felt like an extension of my family, you know? I loved it. So when I had to leave that, I didn't find the same thing in town. So I then had to think about, I wasn't born a doctor. I don't have to stick to it if I don't get, you know, life is about feeling fulfilled. We don't work for money, in my view. We actually work for a purpose. And one of those is feeling fulfilled. It's feeling like you're making a difference. And when that stops, then it's your responsibility to say, what now? And for me, it was education. Education to me has always been everything.
I have to say it's something which is very close to my heart.
I know. I've realized that you also have a PhD and you've been studying. Yeah, it's my passion. I actually come alive in the corridors of institutions, you know. Anyway, so I did an MBA. A major in corporate finance and leadership, and I had already started when I was in general practice to be in business, like I had a bakery next to my practice, but in 1994, when you got independent, I actually formed a company, an investment company, women investment company, and we did investments. One of those investments we still have. So I actually, it exposed gaps in my knowledge, because all I was really is a doctor and a business. Yes, I had been in business in a small scale as a child. You know, my parents were hustlers, so I got involved in, our dad had a tuck shop that he ran over weekends, and my sister and I would do that for him over weekends when we're not at school. But except for those small encounters and also the bakery, I wasn't a business person, really. And I always believe, and I think I'll always believe that, that there's nothing you cannot learn. And that's what education is about. So I went to business school because I believed I can learn, and which I did. And corporate finance, why corporate finance? When we were putting deals together, it used to concern me because I had these financial advisors. There was the deal, and I never knew whose interests are they in, do they have, because there's always this success fee. And so the success fee is a percentage of the size of the deal. So the bigger the deal, which means you pay more, the better for the financial advisor. That's how I used to look at it. And it used to worry me that I don't understand what they're talking about. All I know in terms of what drives the deal, what drives the business. And business school taught me that, you know. But then, as you know, just academic training still needs experience for you
if you've just got the theoretical piece,
it doesn't
often
really
think
help
it's
you.
Such a pity, because it lives in that theoretical level,
exactly.
And it needs to be applied to really benefit everyone.
That's why I went and worked at HSBC, because I wanted to apply what I had learned. And it was a shock, a cultural shock. I'd never worked for anyone else before. And just to get into HSBC was difficult. I was 40 when I got my MBA, and I was a doctor. There's this stereotype that you're a doctor, we'll put you in a box, penicillin, Panado, that's all you know?
I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah.
But I think that's an offline conversation we can have.
So, yeah, that was one of the toughest periods of my life. I've got the MBA now, and I want to take the leap and change profession completely. Who's going to trust that I can, you know? 40-year-old woman who's been in charge of her destiny, running her own practice, can she actually work for someone? Does she, you know what I'm saying? That was very challenging. And I thank two people for that. Patsy David, we were together at a business school, and she introduced me to a guy called Richard Boomer. And Richard Boomer took a chance on me. He used to be the CEO of Corporate Finance and Advisory. So they took a chance on me, and that's how I got into corporate finance, investment banking. And I never looked back. It was so empowering.
And with the finance sector, going back to what you mentioned before about being engaged with community, finance touches absolutely everybody. And when you're brokering these types of deals and arrangements, you're really connecting that whole ecosystem.
Exactly. You do. That was very special. And when we put, actually I was involved in a few transactions, and you then get access, because it was empowerment transactions. So you get access to different empowerment groups, and you can actually, during those days, you actually had to have a woman empowerment group as part of the whole SPV. Obviously, it's interesting now that I say that, because I was talking to Dr. Pumzile Mlambo-Ncuka. And she said something quite interesting. She says, when you have a quota that says 30% will go to women, automatically you are affirming men for 70%.
It's almost seen as our target is 30.
Exactly.
So when we get to that target, we'll just stop.
Exactly. But the point is, you are saying men, 70% is yours. So it's been actually quite interesting. But yeah, it was a beautiful journey. I learned a lot. And so when I left, I'd never stopped having business. So I just went back to what I love, doing stuff for myself.
And you mentioned that you had your MBA when you were 40.
Mm.
Then you went on and you acquired your doctorate.
At 53.
At 53. Congratulations. Proof in the pudding that it is never too late to not learn, and that learning is a lifelong journey.
Mm.
And you investigate in your thesis the intersection of race, gender, and social class in women CEOs' career progression, mm-hmm. as well as strategies for gender transformation at a leadership level.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I find quite fascinating, I mean, it's a bit of a dated study now, but in 2012, Businesswoman South Africa did a study, and out of a census on JSE-listed companies, they found that only 3.6% were women.
Mm-hmm.
which I think is a shocking statistic. And I'd really love it if you could please just expand on your research thesis for us.
Okay. You know, I used to, interesting, you should mention that Business Women Association statistic, Amelia, because I used to go to those, they used to present them at Nedbank, because Nedbank was the sponsor for the censor. And I used to listen to these 3%, 4%, and I always wondered, who are these women and what's their story? And by the way, not much has changed. You say 2012, 2015, it actually bounces between 3.5 and 4.7 thereabouts. It never goes beyond that. So when I embarked on this journey of doing the doctoral thesis, I wanted to give voice to these women. I wanted them to tell their life stories. And there were many reasons for that, because when we investigate an issue as important as this, I think quantitative research doesn't do justice to the issues, because it's actually qualitative issues. You actually want to hear the women, those that have done well, why have they done well, what have they encountered along the way, and just look at, I actually made a deliberate effort to look at the social identities, because there is an assumption that because you are in the same race, you're the same. Because you are one gender, you're the same. And yet we're all so different within the same race, within the same gender. So I actually took the three identities because I wanted to find out, how does social class impact on what you become, or just the journey that you have to take to become whatever you become at the end of the day. And when I looked at research that had been done in the past, one of those was done in 2009 by Professor Ngambi and Professor Stella Ngomo, just looking at all the studies that were done in the continent in the past, I think, 10 years or 20, and they just looked at how many of those studies investigated the gender issues and the inequality, and there were so few. And when it came to looking at the social identity and the impact, there wasn't much. So that's why I said, okay, this is an area that I would like to look at, but especially social class. People are more comfortable talking about race and gender, but the social class thing is so fluid that people shy away from it. When I did the study, actually, and I did the interviews with the women that I interviewed, it was interesting that even when you asked a direct question, they just, people don't deal well with class.
Feeling uncomfortable.
Exactly. They feel uncomfortable.
And I think often it's because of how far removed where they originally came from is from to where they've got to.
That's so true. That's so true. So I found that when I looked, because I made sure that I had all, well, not all, but most of the races, because I didn't have Asian in terms of Chinese, but I had Indian Africans, I had Africans, I had white Africans, I had colored. So, and then I had different classes within those. I found it so interesting that social class indeed had an impact. And when I say social class, I mean the initial social class. The social class that was determined by your parents,
your roots,
who you are. You found that the women, at least in the study, African women, had to be a higher social class. Now, it's going to be, we've come a long way. Earlier in the day, before apartheid was eradicated on paper, if you were black, you were inferior, so you were working class. If you were African, you were actually at the bottom of the pile. So that's one of the reasons I believe that people were uncomfortable, because even now, because we're still the same people we were pre-1994, though much has changed, but certain things are still ingrained in their minds that if I show my face, I'm a working class person because I'm African and I'm a woman. You know what I'm saying? So it's still going to take a while before, if ever actually, before your race, automatically before you open your mouth, defines your class.
I think it's race, it's gender.
Uh-huh.
There's this whole discriminatory bouquet. And it all goes to things from an identity point of view. I haven't done a lot of reading from Steve Biko's perspective, but what he said was just so true. When your identity is taken away from you, you've
Who
got nothing.
You?
Who are you? Exactly.
Who are you?
There's no roots.
No.
And we all need a foundation to build from, grow from, and to relate to.
That's why I always say, I'm happy you raised that, Amila, because I always say I'm very impatient. But in 1994, when I joined those long queues, I could have just sat in that queue. Even if I died in that queue, I would die happy. Because what it gave me is an identity. All of a sudden, I belonged to my country of birth. I was African. This was home. Prior to that, who was I? You know? So, yeah.
And reflecting on that, whenever I see the images of people standing in the queues, I almost see it as a venal network. And that, for me, is the special part. It's our people, our country, connecting in one to everything that belongs to us.
That's so true.
Today, we're talking to Dr. Judy Dlamini, the chairperson of the Embakani Group.
Hi, I'm Zonke Dikana, a South African Afro-soul musician, songwriter, and producer. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band, also available on DSTV channel 802. Today, we're talking to Dr. Judy Dlamini, the chairperson of the Embakani Group. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter, at Womanity Talk. In our first segment, Dr. Dlamini shared some aspects of her career journey and a few of the challenges that she's experienced changing from being a medical doctor to moving into corporate finance. She reiterated that you are never too old to learn, having achieved an MBA at 40 and a doctorate at 53, with a compelling study addressing the intersection of race, gender, and social class in women CEOs' progress and strategies for gender transformation at leadership level. Now, going back to the thesis, I know we detracted slightly, but one of the academic contributions you made was the wheel theoretical model. Mm-hmm. Could you share with us a little bit about that?
One of the things that I wanted, I used grounded theory, and I wanted the women to actually say what they believe led to their success, but also what they believed would actually lead us to equity in terms of gender at leadership level. They mentioned five things. One of them, it starts with the woman herself. You actually have to invest in yourself. You have to have the will to lead. Because unless we have the will to lead, we are not going to be able to lead. But also the next layer is support from family. Most of the women that I interviewed, I think 80% of them were married with husbands and kids, and some extended family. So your domestic worker, one of the women actually interestingly said, the most undervalued women in this country, and I think it's globally, for those that have access to domestic workers, are the domestic workers. They allow us to have our careers, but they get nothing in return, not even recognition, you know? So that is the support system, or extended family. Some were supported by their mother, some were supported by their mother-in-law. So that's the other layer that makes it possible.
They're the enablers.
Enablers, definitely, that we need to recognize and acknowledge. And then it's the organization, leadership within the organization, policies within the organization. And the fourth lever is government, the quotas. That's another story, because women are divided when it comes to that. But I'll tell you what my position is. And the other layer is society. Just the stereotype, gender stereotypes, sexual orientation stereotype within the society. It's therefore a wheel that has to pull in the same direction so that there's movement forward. That has to be engaged, those levers that have to be pulled if we are ever to get equity.
No, I think it's fantastic. We talk about this topic continuously on the show, And it's great to see how you managed to coordinate and put in these various five levers to synthesize into a model to take things forward. Mm-hmm. And one of the points that you tapped on was from a quota point of view. Mm. And we raise gender equality as an issue in this program, but it is becoming more and more a global focus. South Africa, about 2 years ago, had started working on the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill, which then lapsed. But one of its principal aims was about promoting equality of women across the board, whether it was in the government space or private space. And when Minister Susan Chibanga was on the program, she said, we can't talk about equal society when we are treated unequally. And I'd just like it if you could share, given the research that you've done, some of your perspectives on gender equality, and if you think, you did say you were going to offer us your position, that legislation can improve gender gaps to help achieve a 50-50 representation.
I don't see how else we can do it. If you look at the UK, they introduced 30% for the boards, non-executive directors, and they made progress after they introduced that. Now they've introduced 30% for executive leaders in terms of gender. I happen to sit on the same board with the chairman of that initiative, Sir Philip Hampton, and I was interested to know why he took up that position, because there are at least two thoughts. There's a guy who will say, I'll support it because I believe in equality, like an Obama. And there's a guy who will say, I support it, and that's Philip. I'll support it because it makes financial sense. We're investing so much money on the education of these women, and yet we're not seeing any return. They have to lead so that we get our money back, you know. So I do believe that men are in charge. They are comfortable with amongst themselves, and it's easy for them to promote people that look and talk like them. And unless you destabilize that, or actually, what's even better, you acknowledge those that push the equality story and also reward them. Because unless we recognize men that support women, unless we give them rewards for doing that, there is no incentive. Men love recognition. Men are competitive. And that is why the UN Women Executive Director, Dr. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcobo, started the He for She initiative. And then she went on to start the 10 by 10 by 10 impact, which she announced in Davos, where all the big decision makers congregate every year. And why is that important? The 10 by 10 by 10, it's actually 10 political leaders, so it's heads of state. The other 10, it's academic leaders, university professors that are heads of universities. And the other 10 is business people, business CEOs of companies. So when you actually say to them, you will achieve equity by this time, choose three areas or two areas where you believe you can do it. You make them commit in front of everyone, and guess what? They compete against each other. They don't want to lose face. What a better way to actually make sure people do what they are supposed to do. Because if you just say it's common sense, they'll do it. They don't, they haven't. Just look at the first woman, the first country that allowed women to vote, right? New Zealand, 1873. How long did it take before we had a woman president in the world that was not related to the predecessor and actually was elected? 1975. When did we start having just the first woman president in the continent? 1993. So you see things you need, if we are to reach gender equity in leadership by, what are they saying now, 2030?
Yes. Well, I read something by, we would achieve equality by 2133. And
it's
not acceptable. No, well, none of us are going to be around.
Exactly.
And it's something I want achieved in my lifetime.
None of us, none of our kids, it can't be right, you know. So we do need quotas. And then some people say, that's what they would say to me, but, you know, if you are a quota, then you are perceived as less. And my answer is always, if I am, and that's the price I have to pay for life for my daughter and her child to be better, it's a price I'm happy to pay.
And even on that note, I had an interview with the ambassador from Switzerland, and she said exactly the same thing happened to her. Total underestimation of her capability. And she said, I used it to my absolute advantage.
Okay.
Because once they realized who I was, okay, what I could do, the quota meant absolutely
exactly
nothing. But that was my ticket in.
Yeah, exactly. And it's up to you. It's up to you because you want to change that stereotype, and you can only change it if you deliver. And women can deliver. This is the other thing. When a woman fails, it's every woman that has failed. When a man fails, it's just that man. And it's all wrong. And the other statistic that I've seen, not just in this country, but globally, is that when a company is going through difficult times, more often than not, the few times that you have women leaders elected to positions, it's during those times. So are they setting us up to fail? Are we too desperate to actually say, hell no, this is not right, because it's like, this is the only chance I'm ever going to get? So there are also those issues that we need to look into.
And how do you think in 20, 30 years' time, if we can pursue the quota agenda, if we can have more women in this space, that's what South Africa or Africa would look like concerning women's rights and gender equality?
I want to look at it in a broader sense, because people think if they empower women, if they give equal opportunity to people across race, gender, and whatever other social identity, they're doing a favor to the minority. The thing is, they're not. It's not women that will be better off. It's the countries that will be better off. You know, we will actually have increase in the GDP because guess what? We are not utilizing the human resources that we have. So we actually choose not even 50%, sometimes 20%, because it's not just about gender. It's about gender. It's about race. It's about social class. A upper social class white male has got it all figured out because they are in the majority. They are running the institutions. And when they pass over the baton, they pass it over to people who look like them, the Michael House, the Hilton, or the equivalent Ivy League universities in the world. So that is shortchanging the countries. Not women, not minorities, it's the countries. Because just because you are the race that's supposed to be upper class, the gender that's supposed to be upper class, doesn't mean you necessarily qualify for the position. So we actually have mediocre leadership because instead of looking at a pool of 100 and take and give each one equal opportunity, you look at 12 out of the 100.
True, and it becomes inbred. It's the
exactly
same thought processes that
exactly
are recycled. It doesn't take account of the diversity.
Exactly. You don't celebrate the diversity and the strength in the diversity. That's the challenge.
Today, we're talking to Dr. Judy Dlamini, who is the chairperson of the Mbakani Group.
Hi, this is Lira, South African Afro-soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
Today, we're talking to Dr. Judy Dlamini, the chairperson of the Mbakani Group. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In the previous segment of the show, Dr. Dlamini gave her view on quota systems to achieve gender equality, emphasizing the important role that men play in the drive for gender equality and relaying two dominant thoughts. One, people who support gender equality because they believe that it is the right thing to do. And secondly, people who support gender equality because it makes economic sense, being able to attain return on investment on the development, education, and training of women. She elaborated on her theoretical contribution of the wheel, which is a five-lever approach, starting firstly with women themselves, being able to invest in themselves and having a will to lead. Secondly, the importance of support. Thirdly, the importance of the organization with the policies that they have in place. Fourthly, from a government point of view with the necessary legislation that they have. And fifthly, from a society perspective, where we still have pervasive gender stereotypes. To continue with our discussion, Dr. Dlamini, I'd like to focus on another aspect within your business space and also in terms of some of the CSI work that you do. In August 2016, you stepped down from Anglo-American PLC board to focus on your business. Your previous board engagements have included Discovery Holdings, where you chaired the Remuneration and Transformation Committees, as well as Woolworths Holdings. You are the past chairman of the Sapawu Development Trust, a public benefit trust. You and your husband are founders and trustees of the Imkiwa Trust, which is a family public benefit organization with a focus in rural development and education. And I know that in this past week you did another launch based on the CSI with the trust from an education perspective, where you had increased from primary school, where we had children of approximately 400 kids learning, that you've now been able to increase the capacity to 700 children. You've also opened up a community center. Can you please just expand on this? Because I see it as a way of the work that you've done and achieved, but this is, again, about giving back to community.
It's very important. Thanks, Amelia. It's very important that we give back to the communities where we come from. It worries me just the divide, the gap that keeps on expanding. In this country, we have one of the highest Gini coefficients around the world. And we need, in my view, when we give back, we're paying insurance so that everyone has hope, so that everyone has something to save when this country burns. If we don't do that, the economy and the success that has been attained by a few is not sustainable. So as a family, we've always been, as I said, education is everything. I think if you educate, if you give quality education to every child, no matter where they come from, no matter what color they are, then as a country, we will do so much better. It's in our interest to do that. So 2 days ago, we launched two things. The school was opened by the previous premier of, actually he was an MEC then, Senzo Mkhunu. He was the MEC of Education in 2010 when he actually opened the school that we've supported and happens to be in our farm that was passed on by our great-grandfather, my husband's great-grandfather. And in the last week, we actually launched a sports ground, so we gave more land. And then we put, we actually constructed a sports ground where they can play soccer, they can play netball and cricket. And the reason for that is that in that community, as is the case with a lot of rural communities, is that there's a high pregnancy rate, teenage pregnancy, there's high HIV, because there's no entertainment, you know. And it's so important for our kids to use their bodies to be very conscious of health activities like sport, which is just good for building communities and also building just the right healthy minds for the kids.
And so being given, but also being given those opportunities to go and play sport, to understand also the discipline behind it. I've had several conversations with sports people, and exactly that. It's teamwork. It's understanding where you fit into the mix.
Exactly.
They're all lessons for life.
No, definitely, definitely. So that was the motivation. So we launched that, but we also launched a community center. What we've discovered is that you come from Joburg, you think you know what they need in the rural areas. The thing is, you don't. So before we put it together, we consulted the community for many years. What do you need? Community center, what do you need in the community center? When we put all that together, we built the community center and we handed it over to them. But before we did that, we actually said, how do we make it sustainable? how do we ensure it's not a white elephant? One of the things that is quite a big problem in the rural areas is just jobs, you know. So we had Siyazisiza Trust, which is an NGO that actually teaches communities craftwork. So what they did, they look at the skills that are on the ground already, and then they teach them different types of craft, and they also assist to introduce you to distributors of those crafts to the market, because you need the whole value chain. It's all well and good to be able to do these beautiful things, but you have to be able to sell them so that there's money for the sustenance of the families. So we did that. So at the launch, we were showcasing the different craft that the women and men had been trained on. We also have computers and a network access for people that come for training on computers, adult basic education, because you find that quite a few of the people are illiterate. So you actually want to change that. But also it allows the clinic, the mobile clinic, to be stationed at the community center. We're now looking at those social services that government offers to be able to offer them from the hall.
But with the ITC element that you're bringing in,
yes,
that's so important, because if you look at the way our world, we compete in a global economy.
Oh, yes.
And if people have gone through their education and all they've been doing is pen and paper,
exactly,
they're almost incapacitated when they then move on into the next stage of their life, because they just don't have the tools and the skill set.
Exactly. It's like a different language altogether. It's like being shut out of the real world if you don't have access to that. But we also, it's important in the rural areas that you go back to working the land. So we also gave a tractor a piece of land where they'll actually do that. So it's quite a holistic a support to the community that doesn't just stop when you launch. You actually have my brother-in-law, who is the project manager and CEO of the trust that we've put together for the community, to just make sure they run their own affairs, where there'll be skills exchanged between our family, the Masana family, and the community, so that this lives beyond our own lives. They can actually go on their own when we're no more there and make sure that things continue to work for generations to come.
What a wonderful legacy.
Yeah.
Tune in next week to hear the continuation of our conversation with Dr. Judy Dlamini, who's the chairperson of the Mbakani Group.